Going Linux, Episode 16, Listener Feedback. Welcome to the Going Linux Podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy.
And I'm your co-host, Tom. Going Linux is a podcast for computer users who just want to use Linux to get things done.
This podcast provides you with practical, day-to-day advice on how to use the Linux operating system.
If you're new to Linux, or moving to Linux, or thinking about moving to Linux, then this is the podcast for you.
Our goal is to help make the Linux experience easy for you.
And as usual in the user experience episodes, we cover a topic over a two-month period. In the first month, we do a general introduction and things that are of interest to switchers, and just try to get you comfortable with switching to Linux.
And during the second month, we cover the same topic from a more advanced perspective for users of Linux trying to build their confidence and competence. Between user experience episodes, we have listener feedback episodes like this one, where we answer listener questions and provide additional information on using Linux.
To contact us, just email goinglinux@gmail.com or visit our website at goinglinux.com. There you're going to find show notes, articles, information, and detailed instructions with screenshots. In today's episode, of course, listener feedback.
In this episode, we'll answer some of your questions. We hope that you'll find this episode interesting, giving you information that will help you in adopting Linux.
And it looks like we've received a lot of email this month, Larry.
Yeah, we have, and I think it's because our listenership has been increasing steadily. We're looking at our website statistics regularly, and the podcast is getting more popular all the time. High fives and many thanks to our new and loyal listeners. We use Google Analytics to monitor visits to the website, and we're averaging about, well, almost 40 visits a day, and almost 800 unique visitors over the past 30 days alone.
Wow.
We also use the Internet Archive statistics to monitor the downloads of the podcast. And that indicates that each of our episodes has been downloaded about 1,000 times, with the most popular episode being episode number 9 with 1,650 downloads last time I looked, which was about a week or so ago. In that episode, it was an introduction to adjusting to Linux. There we discussed creating desktop icons in Linux, using the mouse, things you can do in Windows and how you can do them in Linux, getting help for Linux and Linux applications, and Linux distributions support resources. We'll have a few things to say about that later in this episode. It's obviously a little difficult to tell exactly how many people are listening, since some of the website hits may be multiple downloads by podcatching software or even just polling by podcatching software, and some of the people who never visit the website do listen regularly through their podcatcher subscriptions to the podcast.
Right.
So it's a little tough.
Okay, well, how about we do something that might give us a little more accurate count. Let's conduct an informal poll to see how many people are actually listening.
That's great.
So, all you listeners out there that are listening to the Going Linux podcast, do us a favor and let us know you're listening. Just for this month, we'd like you to go to Podcast Alley and vote for us. Now, it's not complicated. You'll find the link on our website at goinglinux.com. Just look for the black and red icon on the left side of the site. And that takes you to our listing on Podcast Alley. Submit your vote. You just have to follow a couple instructions in the vote box, and that's all you need to do. Podcast Alley then sends you a verification email to make sure you're a real person, not a bot, and just confirm using the link in your email, and you're done. It's that easy. If you like, why don't you hit the pause button right now and go check it out. It only takes a minute, and we'll report our rankings on Podcast Alley next month. How's that sound?
Hey, that's a great idea, Tom. If our listeners vote every month, they will keep us in the upper rankings of podcasts on Podcast Alley. But all we really want you to do is vote once when you hear this. That'll give us an idea of how many people are actually listening to the podcast. Thanks in advance to our listeners. Now, Tom, let's get into our emails. Who do we have first?
We've got Ryan. And Ryan says, hi. Hi, Ryan. I'm glad I found this podcast. It's been very useful, but I was expecting to learn how to compile an application from source. Do you know of a good place where I can find out how to do this? Thanks, and keep up the good work. Ryan S.
Well, Ryan, thanks for your email first. I'm glad as well that you found the Going Linux podcast. Our focus is much more on the new Linux user who's more comfortable using the graphical user interface than the command line. So I'm afraid that compiling from source would scare off most of those listeners. But not to leave you without any direction at all, I'll provide you with a link to a Linux Journal article that happens to be from about 1996, that'll give you a good start. It's entitled A Beginner's Guide to Compiling Source Code, and it's by Larry Ayers. The URL is pretty short, so let me just read it here. It's linuxjournal.com/article/216. You might also have some success finding what you want with an online Linux tutorial rather than a podcast. You'll find links to some excellent tutorials on our website under the Articles tab.
Good answers, Larry. I have been able to compile, and it's really not that scary. It's just typing in a couple of commands, and then all kinds of stuff happens. But I'm really not sure what's going on. It worked, but how the heck does compiling from source fit into Linux?
Well, as I mentioned to Ryan, it's a rather advanced topic for this podcast, but let me try to make it clear without oversimplifying too much. When a computer program is written, it's in a form called source code. Typically, it won't run on your computer at all until it's compiled, which is a form of processing it so that it becomes an operational program that will work on a specific operating system. You can usually get open source software pre-compiled and packaged, for example, as RPM files for Red Hat-based distributions of Linux, DEB files for Debian distributions, and sometimes even as EXE files for Windows. These are all designed to run on almost any system with the operating system it's compiled for, regardless of its configuration. Proprietary software is always provided that way. The nice thing about open source applications is that they're always available as source code as well. Linux distributions always have compiler software available in their repositories for you to install, and this compiler software allows you to take that source code and compile it yourself.
Okay. So, if I can get it already put together, compiled, or I can get the source code and compile it myself, what's the advantage in doing it myself?
Well, the advantage to compiling your own applications is that you get a tailor-made installation customized for the exact hardware and software configuration on your computer. And in my response to Ryan by email, I explained that we have really not heard of any other podcasts that have actually covered compiling applications from source code in any depth. Chess Griffin's Linux Reality podcast that we've mentioned a few times on this show is a little more advanced than ours, but even he hasn't covered the topic. In fact, most of the other podcasts we know about are either Linux evangelist or Linux discussion type podcasts that don't go into step-by-step depth that right. Ryan is asking for.
Okay, so maybe compiling from source is a topic we could present in a future podcast in a way that wouldn't be scary to, let's say, switchers from Windows.
Yeah, maybe, but for now, we're covering much more basic topics, and I really don't expect to get into something as complex as compiling source code anytime soon.
Right. So, Ryan, we hope that the podcast will still have some value to you, and I know that we've received some comments from some pretty advanced users of Linux who say they've learned some new things from our practical tips. And thanks again for listening.
Okay, so our next email is from listener Dennis. He wrote, "Hello, I've been trying to download and burn some live CDs of different distributions, and when I boot from the CD, it tells me that the PC can't boot in DOS mode." He's obviously using a Windows machine. "I have burned ISO images in the past, and they've worked. Now, I can't get them to work. I use CD Burner XP Pro and InfraBurner. All I should need to do is to download the ISO file from an FTP site and burn it to a CD, making it bootable, right? I'm very passionate about computers and want to learn more about Linux. Thanks, Dennis in Florida." What do you think, Tom? Can we help Dennis? I know that the most common cause of the type of error message he describes is a misstep in how the CD is actually burned from the image. So what do you think?
I think the first thing Dennis needs to check is to look in Windows Explorer and see if what's on that disk is an ISO file. If it is, then it didn't work. The ISO file should contain all of the files that would burn to the CD.
So what you're saying is if he sees a single file with the extension .iso, he's just copied the CD.
Right.
Or he's copied the image to the CD rather than burning the image properly.
Right, it didn't unpack somehow. So he needs to go back to his burning software and search the menus for a selection that lets him burn a CD from an ISO image. There should be a command that says something like burn CD, burn from ISO, or create a bootable CD from an image, or something like that.
Yeah. Something else I've seen people do is to use the burning software to make the CD bootable again after burning the ISO image. If that's what he's done with a Linux live CD, Dennis is going to get the kind of error that he's seen there. With a live CD, when you've burned the image, you don't have to make it bootable. It's already
right.
Bootable.
Now, Dennis, if you check the disk and it's got lots and lots of files and folders, great. And I know this is really simple, but let's think about it. Before you can boot that disk, you have to go into your BIOS, your basic input-output system, and set your machine up to boot from a CD if there's a bootable CD there. To get to your BIOS, reboot and read really, really fast. You should see something like press delete to enter BIOS setup or something on that order. Once you're in there, look for a list of boot devices and make sure that CD-ROM is before your hard drives. That way the machine will look at the CD-ROM before it looks at the hard drive to find the first bootable device. And make sure you save an exit after that's done.
Yeah, he may actually have it set up that way, but if he doesn't, depending on how old the computer is, the key to press that gets into the BIOS setup might be something different. For example, on other manufacturers, sometimes you have to press the escape key. On older ThinkPads, you hold down the F1 key while booting. More modern ThinkPads use the F8 key instead, and the F12 key takes you right to the list of bootable devices without having to go through the BIOS setup. No matter what the case, the key to press will be displayed on the computer as it starts up. And as you mentioned, Tom, you have to read really fast in most cases
there
to
you
figure
go.
It out. Do we have any other suggestions for Dennis?
Yeah, one more thing. Looking back over his email again, he says something about a DOS message that it won't run restart in DOS. I think what he might be doing is restarting in DOS rather than doing a cold boot. You want an ice cold boot from zero up. So try turning the machine off and then boot it back up again and see if that helps. That all said, we're sorry to say it, but some machines simply can't or won't boot a Linux disk or a thumb drive. I have an old Dell that just won't, and I've seen other Dell models that are the same. I've got a buddy that has a really nice non-Dell machine, and it's got the same problem. It's a long shot, but you may be able to fix that if you go to the site of the people who wrote the BIOS. You should see who they are on the very first blank white screen when the machine starts to boot. Visit their website and see if there's a recent firmware patch for the BIOS.
Yeah, and sometimes with older machines, it's just not possible. They can't boot from a CD, Linux or otherwise. They're just too old. And if your computer's more than, let's say, about 4 or 5 years old, it's going to be impossible.
Right.
Our next email is from listener Jonathan, who wrote, and this is my favorite email of the month. Going Linux crew, he writes, I have used OpenSUSE during the last summer. However, when school started, I switched back to Windows XP. I did this for several reasons. First, my iPod, I could never get to sync, and Microsoft Office is far superior to any open source software, for example, OpenOffice. However, actually last night I was really angry with how slow my Windows computer was, and I knew that with Linux, my computer had been much faster. So I went and used Partition Magic to resize my drive so that I can have Linux on my computer again. Sounds like he's dual booting. He's repartitioned to be able to dual boot into Windows and to Linux. He continues, I was wondering if you guys would be able to answer two of my problems. The first is, how would I sync my iPod? The second is, I use Microsoft's OneNote to take notes in class. I was wondering if there's a good Linux piece of software that does the same thing as OneNote. I'm running OpenSUSE 10.2 using GNOME as the desktop. I'm a computer science major, so switching to Linux is actually better for me. However, I also like my iPod and OneNote, so I had to use Windows until I just got really angry with it. I really love your show and enjoy it very much. Thanks for any help you can be, Jonathan.
Hey, Jonathan, thanks for the great email. And since you're already using a GNOME-based distribution, you likely already have an excellent alternative to iTunes installed. It's called Rhythmbox, and it has built-in support for the iPod. So does Amarok, by the way. If Rhythmbox isn't already installed in OpenSUSE, it's available in the source repositories under YAST. There are links in the show notes to articles using both of these applications with an iPod. Now here's a disclaimer, I don't have an iPod, so I can't give first-hand advice in that department. If all else fails, fall back on your support community, it's there for you. About a week ago, the new iPods came out with a nasty encryption to seal out Linux users. That meant that Linux users could no longer sync their iPods to Amarok, and it took about 2 days before the open source community found a way around that. So that's fixed again.
Yeah, and as we're recording this, I've noticed in my Windows computer, I have iTunes installed so that I can just check to make sure that the iTunes feed of our podcast works. And I've noticed that Apple has provided yet another update. This is probably the second one in just a few days iTunes. So I don't know whether that's to break something else, or whether that's something related to the iPhone or what, but they've been having a good time turning off people's added functionality.
Okay, in a follow-up email, Jonathan provides some additional information. He says, there are several main features that I like in OneNote. I like the ability to keep all of my notes in one program, and I have a tab for each class, and then within the tabs for the class, I have a page for each lecture. I like the ability to mark topics as important, as questions, as remember for a test. I like the ability that it exports tasks to Outlook. It will not obviously work for Linux. Finally, the last function I find very useful is the clip button, which allows you to take an entire section of a website or another document and basically paste it into your notes for the lecture. Obviously, all these features are not going to be possible for a Linux version, but these are the main functions that I use in class.
After doing a little research on alternatives to Microsoft Office's OneNote, I did find one application that I think I can recommend. It's called Basket, and it seems to have most of the functions that Jonathan uses. It's available for download at basket.kde.org, and even though it's a KDE application, it works just fine in GNOME without any trouble. And it's also available in many distributions repositories without having to go to the KDE website to download it. I found Basket version 1.01 in Ubuntu's repositories and installed it on my own machine just to test it out in preparation for answering Jonathan's question. I also saw that there was an earlier version of Basket available in OpenSUSE's repositories in Yast.
I went to the website too, and here are some basic features. It says that it easily takes all sorts of notes, that it allows you to collect research results and share them, centralize your project data and reuse them later, quickly organize your thoughts in idea boxes, keep track of your information in a smart way, make intelligent to-do lists, and a lot more.
One key difference between Basket and OneNote is that OneNote creates what it calls pages and then allows you to place them into folders. Those are the metaphors that OneNote uses for what it creates. In Basket, everything is called, you guessed it, a basket. You can create pages called sub-baskets and place them into a basket. It's exactly like notes in a folder, but it's just everything's called a basket. There's even a tree display that displays the hierarchy on the left-hand side of the window, so it's easy to find what you want, even though everything's called a basket. So, Jonathan, instead of a page of notes for each lecture, you would have a basket of notes. Instead of a tab for each class, you would have a basket for each class. Each class basket would contain the class notes. You can tag anything you want with labels and icons, just like you label your OneNote notes today. Basket even lets you create active checkbox icons for to-do lists that, when checked, indicate that the task is completed. Basket also has a clip-like feature like OneNote. It actually lets you right-click anywhere on a page and insert text, an image, a link, an application or file launcher, or a screenshot. Maybe I just haven't found it yet, but the one thing I don't see is an export of calendar entries or to-do lists.
Right, and really this isn't one email here. We went back and forth with Jonathan a little bit and helped him through this thing. At first he had trouble installing Basket. I think he downloaded it from the Basket website and tried compiling it from source. And I can say now that I know what that's all about. In our last episode, we gave some examples of adding repositories in Debian-based distributions. Maybe we can give a step-by-step for Jonathan, since he's using an RPM distribution, OpenSUSE. That would be of interest to anyone else using OpenSUSE who needs to add repositories too.
Sure, I did some experimenting around, and version 0.6.0 of Basket is all that's available from the default repositories for OpenSUSE 10.2. I did a little searching, and I found a repository that has a more recent version. I actually had to add the Guru repository, which is one of the authorized repositories listed by OpenSUSE in their documentation, and was able to update Basket to version 1.0.2. It installed and worked flawlessly. I'll include these step-by-steps in some detail in the show notes, but basically what I did was I opened the Yast Control Center, and just to review, Yast is SUSE's package manager. I clicked the icon for installation source. To add the Guru source, you click the Add button, select HTTP as the type of source you want to add, and then click Next. You enter the following server name, ftp.gwdg.de. That's the website for this Guru repository. And then you enter a rather long string of text that indicates the directory on their server. It's the /pub/linux/misc/suseuser-guru/rpm/10.2/rpms. And since capitalization is almost always something you need to be careful of in Linux, I suggest that rather than try to follow these instructions
right
through the audio podcast, that you go to the show notes and look at the steps. Anyway, you click Next and confirm to import a key, which is essentially a security measure, and then click Finish to synchronize the new source. Now, synchronizing with a website in Germany from the US often takes a while, so be patient. When you're back at the YAS Control Center, you click Software Management. And then you use the search box that's in YAS to find Basket, the application, and click the little checkbox that's next to its name in the search results. Ensure that the Auto Check checkbox is checked to ensure that any needed additional packages, called dependencies, or upgrades to existing packages are found and installed automatically for you. Click Accept and the installation begins. Once it's installed, you'll find Basket Desktop Organization Tool under Utilities and Desktop in SUSE's Applications menu.
And the happy ending was Jonathan was able to install Basket, and he was gracious enough to write us a review. And that whole review is going to be in the show notes. It's kind of long, but I would like to summarize it. Jonathan is running OpenSUSE on a laptop now, and he loves it that it boots and quits so quickly. For some reason, the battery life is reduced for some reason, and I don't know why that might be.
I don't know either. The power management in Linux is different from Windows, so there may be some differences there.
I would search the repositories for the word battery and see if there's something for OpenSUSE to manage his power.
Yeah, maybe so.
As far as Basket goes, like OneNote, he says, he's able to organize notes for each lecture. Unlike OneNote, Basket has no tablet drawing tools. Okay, that's a little bit of a bummer if you're running a tablet.
Yeah, I think Jonathan had mentioned he's not, so that wouldn't be a problem for him. But he's okay writing a review, so it's good that he included that.
Excellent, yes. He says both programs are able to grab a screen or a section of a screen, and he says that's great when the professor has a presentation online. Both let you tag items. Basket highlights in colors depending on importance. While Basket lacks some of OneNote's features, it's lighter and faster since it isn't tied into the Office apps.
Yeah.
Overall, Basket is a great Linux alternative for taking notes in class. And he says one cool feature of Basket is that it lets you use custom background colors for each note. He says he hopes that helps. Well, it sure does. Thanks, Jonathan.
It does indeed.
And I'm using Basket now, and I love it.
Me too. I didn't uninstall it after testing it out. It's a really great program.
It is. And when it's minimized, there's almost no overhead. So it's not taxing your machine to have it ready to go in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And, really, this is a great example of what Linux switchers can expect. Linux isn't a clone of Windows or of Apple's. Every operating system has its own look and feel and its own strengths. If you come in expecting that, you'll be a happy camper.
You bet. Well, I'd like to thank Jonathan, and as you've mentioned, we'll include his entire review on our website. And it was very kind of him to take the time to provide such a thorough review. I'm sure that if there are any students among our audience, and I know there will be, who are using Linux, Jonathan's review will help them to determine whether or not Basket's for them. It's very cool.
It is. Okay, it's really freaking cool. It's kind of like it was made for me. I had all of these little ODT files, all of these little document files with notes about this and that, things that I wanted to remember. And now I've got those all in Basket. They're all in one place. And I couldn't be happier with it. And here's a lesson I've learned from this and another application called K3B. And that is that KDE applications, which are normally for Kubuntu, will run fine in GNOME Ubuntu. So it looks like bits of each can live together in peace, and that's great.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. It doesn't matter which desktop an application is written for the most part, it will run on anything, regardless of whether the application is written for KDE, GNOME, or another desktop manager. It pretty much runs under any other desktop
Wonderful.
Manager. Our next email is from a not-so-happy listener. Jeff in Orlando wrote to both Chess Griffin at Linux Reality and to us here at Going Linux. He wrote a very long email, so I'll read just the first few sentences and then summarize the rest. He writes, "Just thought you might want some insight into my failed attempt to move to Linux. My initial goal was simple, to get a simple distribution and set up my current HP 1200 printer and port my email and bookmarks. I did a full installation, not live CD, both with Ubuntu and then with PC Linux. That turned out to be my favorite. It has a dead simple look and ran great from the start." He goes on to say that he spent 2 hours unsuccessfully trying to get his printer working and to move his email bookmarks. He goes on to blame, in part, hardware vendors for not supporting Linux as thoroughly as Windows.
Wow. Unfortunately, I think Jeff's ordeal illustrates some of the frustration experienced by Linux newbies. That's why we're here doing this podcast, for people new to Linux, especially those moving from Windows. Larry, don't we have a couple of online articles about how to port email and bookmarks?
Yes, we do. In fact, we have at least one article on each topic.
I have to wonder why, if he's really listening to all the podcasts, he didn't find that step-by-step guide and follow it. So let's include links in the show notes for each of those, just to make it easier for our listeners to find. What about the rest of his email?
Well, he also mentions there seems to be considerable arrogance amongst the Linux community regarding mastery of the command line. Yeah, it sounds like the potential solutions he found were all command line heavy. I know it's difficult for switchers from Windows to deal with the command line rather than the graphical user interface. That's one of the things that inspired me to start this podcast. Although the command line is a much more efficient way of handling almost any administrative task, it comes at the expense of being difficult for today's average computer user to understand. People who just want to use their computer to get things done don't want to learn how to fix or even set up their computer. They just want it to work. I know in the past few years there's been a lot of work on the part of the Linux development community in simplifying the configuration of the operating system. It would do wonders for the widespread adoption of Linux if they could somehow simplify all of these tasks so that everything is self-configuring, but even Windows and the Mac require tweaking to get them working just right. Jeff goes on to detail his printer setup ordeal and describes some display setting issues as well. He ends by writing, "Sorry to say, I'm unsubscribing from all my Linux podcasts after today, but email me if you like. I'll check back with Linux in a year or so and give it another try. Thanks for all the great help you're providing the open source community. Jeff in Orlando."
He doesn't sound like a happy camper at all. That's too bad. If Jeff had looked, what would he have found on his printer issue?
Well, I looked at the printer compatibility list we have on our articles page, and although Jeff didn't say whether his printer was an HP Business Inkjet 1200 or an HP DeskJet 1200C or an HP LaserJet 1200, all of those printers are rated works perfectly on that site. Since he mentioned double-sided printing, let's assume it's a laser printer, which is the last one, the LaserJet 1200. That one has quite a few comments about people having some problems getting it set up. There's some stuff about PostScript levels and failed USB connections and Ethernet connections and things like that. The bottom line is that for basic printer functionality, the HP LIP driver, which is one that's provided by default in most Linux distributions, is what's recommended, and it works just fine out of the box for most distributions. In fact, one comment written by the editor of the site noted that Mandrake 8.2 configures that particular printer automatically.
Right. Well, we're not claiming that Linux is going to be a bed of roses in all cases. We're not guaranteeing that Linux is going to be able to support any old thing you hang on your computer right off the bat. But if you go out and check in your support community, the odds are you're going to find what you need.
Yeah, we've mentioned in the past on other episodes of Going Linux that there are distribution support sites and community wikis and message boards and articles on Linux Journal and other online publications. And one of the things that I've learned about Linux is that some distributions do a better job with some hardware than others do. Sometimes you just have to experiment with the various distributions until you find one that works with everything that you have on your system. What's our next email, Tom?
Okay, well, this is our last one from listener Bill. And Bill wrote, "Hello, great podcast." Well, of course it is, Bill. "I have two questions that might generate some interest. Number one, I have a Verizon Pocket PC, and I want to sync with KMail. Is that possible, or do I need to download additional applications? Number two, how do I sync my iPod with Linux? I want to start bringing over my music to my Linux desktop." Bill, it sounds like you might also have been speaking with Jonathan from a couple of emails ago. And he wraps up with, "Thanks. Keep up the good work. Regards, Bill in Irvine, California." Thanks, Bill.
Yeah, Bill, thanks a lot for the email, and thanks for listening to the podcast. For KDE-based distributions, your first choice alternative for iTunes that may already be installed by default on your distribution is something called Amarok. Amarok has support built in and works perfectly with the iPod. In reality, both Amarok and Rhythmbox work equally well under KDE and under GNOME. So both you, Bill, and Jonathan should try them both and use whichever you like the best. We've already provided Bill with some links to articles on Amarok, and we'll include those in the show notes.
Okay, Larry, and then Bill also has a question about a Pocket PC. I have never even touched one of those things. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, in fact, to use a Pocket PC with Linux, you'll definitely need some additional software. And, of course, it's available for free. In episode 12 of Going Linux, we recommended two packages to another listener with a similar question. Those packages were MultiSync and SynCE. Those can allow you to sync a Pocket PC with the Evolution mail client that comes on Ubuntu and other GNOME-based distributions. SynCE, or SynCE-KDE, is an application that can be used to sync with KMail, a mail client that comes on many KDE distributions. Both of those applications are available in the Ubuntu repositories, and we'll provide some links to Ubuntu community articles on those, as well as some additional links to other articles that may be of help.
Okay, well, again, Bill, thanks for the email. And let us know how it goes.
And that was our last email. As you mentioned earlier on, Tom, this has been a month of a lot of emails. It's been a very busy month. And in fact, as we have been talking between episodes, you had mentioned that you have an idea, an excellent idea, for another feature for our podcast, Software Pick of the Month. Since this episode is going a bit long, let's start that in our next listener feedback episode.
Okay, cool. I'm looking forward to it, and I already have my software pick of the month picked out. In the meantime, looks like we're going pretty long in this episode, so let's wrap it up.
Okay. In our next user experience episode, we will begin to cover some Linux applications rather than the operating system itself. The next episode is word processors and text editors. Until then, you can go to the articles and show notes at goinglinux.com for more information and detailed instructions. Email us with your comments, questions, and suggestions, or send us an audio comment. We'll play it on the show. Send any of that to goinglinux@gmail.com. You can also subscribe to the podcast if you want to get future episodes delivered automatically. Instructions are on our website.
And remember, if you haven't done it already, please follow the Podcast Alley link on our website and vote for us just for this month. We'll let you know how many listeners we have, and we'll talk to you later.
Thanks for listening. Theme music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.